You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I'm your host, Joe Epley, and today we get the privilege to interview a friend and a pastor who I know, who I really respect learning about his journey. I think that, everyone is a pastor when they wear that title, right? Everyone. But this guy, from my own estimation, is kind of a pastor's pastor. He really dives deep into what it means to love and walk with people. And I'm excited for that to be kind of a lot of what we pulled today. So I'm just pumped for that. For that tone, but before we get into it, I'm obviously pretty excited to go there. But before we get into it, I just want to introduce him, Pastor Stephen Shibley. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Joe. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, good. Well, we're happy to have you. Obviously, you hail to us from the great state of South Dakota, and you've spent a good chunk of your ministry there. But as we always do on this podcast, we know that small town is a place of story and history. You know, we recognize that we are intimately tied to kind of these details of life and where we've been and what we've done. And so we just want to familiarize ourselves with your story. Maybe give us that flyover view of, you know, maybe it started when you got saved at a young age. Maybe you pick us up at Bible college when you started out in ministry. I mean, just pick a spot, but help us maybe get from point A to now and give us the, you know, I was here and I pastored here for this long. I mean, just help us understand the scope of the journey, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was born into a pastor's family. My mom and dad pastored a rural church, little town in southern Illinois, about 150 people. The church probably was about 40 to 50 people. But that's what I was born into. So I literally cut my teeth on a church pew. That's the beginning. But my dad pastored rural churches, took us to Iowa, then to Minnesota. I graduated from high school in Minnesota. Went on to college, North Central University, and then went as a youth pastor to a church in Upper Michigan. Was there only about a year and a half, and then we left there and went and pastored a small church in Minnesota, north of Minneapolis, Mora, Minnesota. Great community, great people, kind of on the edge of the woods. And so sure. We had agriculture and we had people that were.
Yeah, and there's some beautiful country up there for sure.
It's gorgeous, lakes and trees. And so our church, we went there and there were about 15 people. That was, that's.
That's, yeah, rural. You're jumping in both feet forward, you know.
I heard later on that the superintendent, when he was giving my recommendation, he says, well, there's just no way he can hurt it.
And you know what? Confidence. Sometimes that's all the shot you need. You know, there's no way you can screw this up, man.
So we were there 4 years. The church grew. When we left there, there were about 100 people, young families. We needed to build a nursery in the church, okay?
Okay.
Rachel and I were expecting our first. And there was one other couple in the church that was also expecting.
Sure. So you're like, we're about to be in business here. We got to have at least room for two kids.
We're going to have church growth the old fashioned way.
Sure. And
when we dedicated the new nursery, there were 10 babies in that.
Whoa,
nursery.
That's so fun.
So that was the kind of stuff we were seeing. Young couples coming in, young families. It was exciting. We left there and came to South Dakota. I was an associate pastor in Huron. And the church had gone through some major, some splits.
Sure.
They were down to about 150 to 200 people. Yeah, it was some difficult situations. As an associate there, I got to sit in on board meetings. I guess it was my privilege.
Sure.
Some painful meetings.
I was going to say, I imagine some tough conversations in the middle of that.
Well, I remember some of them very specifically. Yeah, they were They were tough. They were coming after the pastor, and I was collateral damage.
Sure.
And then I was elected as DYD, and I did that for 7.5 years traveling South Dakota.
Right. So you're the youth director for South Dakota. That's awesome.
The first DYD. First.
Wow.
DYD.
Yeah. First one in the office. Love it.
So, and then pastored in Watertown, which was, again, it was a small congregation. The Lord helped us, and the church grew. It was just a time of blessing.
Sure.
We left there and went to Rapid City First Assembly. And again, the church grew, and we were blessed, built a new sanctuary there. And then was elected as superintendent from there. So never in all of those locations, I never wanted to leave the one I was at.
Sure.
There wasn't one of them that I felt like I got to get out of here.
Yeah, got to move on. Got to run as far as I can. Yeah.
So just really definitely felt God's hand in directing our lives, and definitely his blessing. Nothing in it that I would claim I could do it. So
sure. Yeah. And just remind me, you know, your tenure as superintendent, which kind of brings you up to, if I'm right, you are you are retired. Yeah. Like you are officially like, hey, I'm taking some time, you know?
Just 3 months ago, we pulled the plug and we became officially retired.
Man, and how many years was it in the saddle for this last position? We served
24 years as district superintendents.
Dang, that's a good chunk of time. Well, good. Yeah, so that brings us up to present day. So what I was excited about is when we got to talk over the phone and just dive into your story and different ways that you pastored, it became really apparent to me that you are like a very relational person. You know, like it seems like you lead relationship forward. It seems like a lot of your metrics for success are running through this idea of like, how are we connecting one to another and growing the church in this way and leading this way? And so a lot of these questions are going to be through that lens. I think that's an incredibly valuable perspective to have on the church. And obviously we're going to take the whole journey. You know, we're going to start kind of with some biblical thoughts and then kind of work through pastoral ministry, you know? And so, so let's just start where we should start. You know, you mentioned to me on the phone, you said Jesus was a relational leader. Love that statement. Give us a brief insight into how you feel he led relationally. Like, what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been blessed to be able to go to Israel and walk the paths that Jesus walked and visit the communities where he grew up and where he ministered. And it's all rural. I mean,
sure. Yeah, it's all small town.
Yeah, that's for sure. That was his ministry. He was known in his community. You know, the people recognize, oh, aren't you the son of Mary and Joseph?
Yeah. Yeah. They always had the genealogy at hand, you know?
Yeah. So it wasn't this anonymous culture that he lived in where there were so many hundreds of thousands of people. He could get lost in the crowd. He was sure. Recognized. He was known. And he knew people that same way.
Mm.
I think, you know, the 12 disciples, he poured himself into 12 men. And that was his launching point. And you think about it, his public ministry was only 3 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, he poured himself into those three people or into those 12 men. He ministered on hillsides, preached from a boat, you know, went into when it says he went into the synagogue. It wasn't this huge edifice. It was these small buildings.
Sure.
50 people would fill it up. So, you know, his ministry was rural, whether he was out in the country or whether he was in town, it was rural.
Sure. And it does lead to a lot of that whole knowing and being known. It does lead to a lot of deep investment in people because he's probably around this same crowd in a large sense, you know? Yeah. So my question is kind of as we start your journey, because I think definitions are important. And I think we could attach, if I said, what is the definition of a pastor? You know, I think that we could attach a lot of things to that. Some people would say, well, let's talk about the heartbeat. Let's talk about the scripture. Let's talk about the leadership skills. Let's talk about the role itself. But I'm interested to hear it from your own words. What does it mean to be a pastor? What is the heart of pastoral ministry to you?
If I could boil it down to one story in
sure.
the New Testament, Jesus is coming to Lazarus. Lazarus has died.
Yeah.
He's in the tomb. And he comes there And he sees the people mourning, and Jesus wept.
Mm.
The emotion that Jesus carried wasn't for Lazarus, because he knew what he was about to do.
Sure.
It was for the people. He had compassion. He genuinely cared about what they were feeling.
Mm.
And, you know, when I look at it, at a pastor is not, you know, just standing behind a pulpit. That's the that's the minority of what they do.
Sure, the tip of the iceberg, if you will.
You know, and sermon preparation, that's still the smaller fraction of what all they do. And that doesn't lower the importance of preaching well and being well prepared. But if you haven't invested in people, you don't have anyone to listen to what God's given you.
Mm.
So it's being where people are. It's going where they go. It's being interested in their lives. I remember visiting one of the guys in our church, and it was after a service.
Sure.
And he was a beekeeper, and I said, man, I've never been around bees. I mean, where I really wasn't afraid.
Yeah, no one's excited to be around bees, yeah, except beekeepers.
So I said, is there a chance that I could go with you? And he lit up. He said, yeah, absolutely. We set a date. I drove out to his place.
Sure.
And we drove from one place to the next, working with the hives and working with the bees. And, you know, I held bees in my hand without them stinging me.
All right.
Or without me wanting to swat them.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about what he did. And when we were all done, he said, Steve, thank you. And I mean, he was emotional.
Yeah.
He says, no one has ever, no pastor I've ever had has ever wanted to come and see what I do.
Wow.
Yeah.
That hits me, Stephen.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I'm thinking, how many times do we miss those opportunities to go where our people are, see what they do, you know, ride on a tractor with them, help them throw bales, you know, whatever they're doing, we just fit in for a couple hours for an afternoon.
Sure.
And that investment, it pays such incredible dividends.
Yeah. So
what did Jesus do? He spent time with people. He ate with the people. He traveled with them. And I think there was one movie I saw depicting Jesus walking down the road with his disciples, and they're laughing and he's slapping them on the back, and it's a good time.
Yeah.
And, you know, having gone with some of my parishioners, we go out hunting together. We go fishing together. I go out to their place and help them. I'll help them by riding in the tractor with them.
Sure, keeping them company, of course.
And, but that relationship gives me the right to speak into their life.
Yeah.
It also gives me a knowledge of who they are and what they do.
Yeah, and really what they struggle with and their fears. I mean, just
exactly.
All of it, you know?
Exactly. I think that's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, that speaks to me a lot. I really think that whole motif of seeing people where they're at. So here's a question, just kind of springing off that. Rural churches are sometimes interesting because they have often a very consistent set of attendees who are longtime residents. You know, these are often people, as we call it, tied to the land, you know, to use the agricultural term.
Sure.
And I feel like this dynamic hits different than in a larger church, because obviously a larger church has these same people. It's not like those people are not there. You know, there's people who've been around for decades and decades, but their proximity to how decisions work, to how pastoring decisions work, it can be like a totally different dynamic. And so how does one pastor, you know, kind of relationally, yeah, kind of pastor through that, kind of pastor with that in mind when there's these same personalities, the same challenges, the same, you know, guy who opposed the building project 10 years ago might still be there when you're trying to do the next addition to the building project? And like, how do these quirks keep coming up, and how can you instruct other pastors to lead through them, you know?
Oh, it takes patience.
Well, that's no fun. Next question. Next question. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. And how does God give you patience? He gives you a situation where you can be patient. So.
Yeah, it's dangerous. But yeah, I'll let you carry on. Sorry.
I've seen churches where, one family, totally dominates.
Yeah. Generationally too,
Yes. So you'll have eight families out of one small church. You can't afford to alienate the family.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden you got an empty building.
Yeah.
And these people are not moving. Like you said, they own the land.
Yeah.
So they're not moving away. They're going to move from your church to a church across town. And it's not going to look well for your congregation. So, yeah, you've got to be patient. What does it say? 2 Timothy 4. To preach the word, be prepared, patiently correct, rebuke, encourage,
sure.
Knowing that I'm going to be here for the long haul as well.
Mm. So there's some personal longevity in the mix.
Yeah, you've got to commit yourself and then just work with them. And I'm not naive enough to say that there aren't some people with misguided intentions, but I really think that they're almost always the minority, not the majority. Sure. So you surround yourself with people that have good intentions and you lead them. If one of their cousins is, misguided, let them be the one who calls them out.
Sure.
You don't have to be the one who is always disciplining the flock.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's actually a unique perspective, the empowering of others to say, hey, we don't have to, kind of be that principal office all the time,
So there was an old adage about if the only tool you have in your toolbox is a hammer, every problem you have looks like a nail.
Sure.
So if the only way that you can deal with something is through confrontation, you're missing out that there are a whole lot of other tools in the toolbox. So don't make the first tool that you grab for, I've got to put this guy in his place. There's other things you can do. And I really think that in patience and in gentleness, these are, the Bible describes us as sheep, and the shepherd, he can shear sheep every year, but he could only butcher them once.
Yeah.
So be gentle with your sheep. They are the future of the flock. So don't beat them up too bad.
Yeah. No, that's huge. I'm thinking about that phrase, you can shear them a lot, but you can only butcher them once. And I'm like, man, that's... I'll preach there.
Yeah.
But I really love that. And I do think it kind of calls back to even what you just said, like one of the tools you chose to lead with was like, can I spend quality time with the guy keeping bees? And like, then when you do have to chat with him about his life and maybe get into some hard stuff, you don't have to just pull out a hammer and carelessly break things. You've invested differently and set yourself up to win. So man, that's really insightful, Pastor Stephen. Let's carry on. So a lot of us as pastors, our particular denominational or rather fellowship background is, the Assemblies of God. And so we kind of have always, felt this strong pull of network of saying, hey, we are going to look out for other pastors, around our states or our areas and get a chance to connect with them. And so and I would argue that even if somebody's listening who's not from that background, again, whether it's a ministerial association in your community, whether you have your own denominational structure, like theoretically, there is a chance for all of us to help create an environment where we connect with others. And there's a lot of chance for us to benefit from an environment that's connecting well with others. And so you've gotten to serve in some of these roles. Being a youth director is a, state level position with the Assemblies of God, where you're now coordinating the, 30, 40, 50, 60, however many churches, and trying to help push the ball forward. And then you got to serve obviously 24 years as superintendent, kind of like for the state of South Dakota for the Assemblies of God, again, pulling all these churches in the same direction. And so in that environment, how did you create a relational environment, and what fruit did that produce, not only in your life, but in the lives of these pastors? Like, Like, if we say, man, we think all pastors should try and be relational with other people, like, what fruit are we hoping from that? So I guess just, you know, tackle it however you want to, but go for it, you know?
You know, I think back to one staff meeting I remember as a district superintendent. So I've got the DYD, a couple of admins, my wife, Rachel. I brought her in before she was even involved as our credential specialist. But we discuss an event and do an evaluation. How did this event go?
Sure.
We were looking at the schedule of our minister's retreat and our district council, and we were just not happy with where it was, not sure. content with what we had done. And we said, what's the best part of council?
Mm.
And everybody in the room said, oh, it's the hallway time.
Mm.
It's the time where you, not where you're just sitting in a pew listening, but where
right.
you have that personal time to talk to your friends, to interact, go out for lunch, just do.
Which is such a bummer because our job is scheduling the speakers and the worship and all the things that we think are going to be these really impactful moments. It's not that they're not impactful, but it is funny that people are like, yeah, my favorite was still kind of this totally independent thing, you know?
Yeah. Or even the positive comments that you get of feedback were, boy, I'm glad you gave us that extra time in between sessions. Mm,
sure. Yeah.
So we started intentionally designing our district events to have that space allowed.
Yeah.
So you didn't just try to run them through and give another classroom session, another teaching session, motivational session, informational. You allowed them to have time where they just talked.
Mm.
At our minister's retreat, we'd have a family meeting.
Sure.
And talk over district activities and what's happening and decisions that were made and why, and Q&A just abundantly. And it created an atmosphere of family. We had disagreements.
Yeah.
We had people that would challenge an idea and say,
sure. Well,
yeah, but, and present another side to an issue or to a plan that we had. And we learned from that. We grew from that. And we all benefited from that interaction, mm. from that family input.
Sure.
So I think it takes some very intentional moves on the part of leadership, whether
sure.
it's local pastor, whether it's district leadership, creating those kinds of spaces.
Yeah, I think sometimes in a modern context, we feel like the need to be very efficient. You know, we feel the need to say, man, I've got a problem. I want a solution. You know, but often when you're at these leaders events, you know, it's not going to be that you're going to walk up to somebody and say, well, I'm struggling with X situation in my church and I need solution Y. But you might start by saying, hey, where are you from? What's your family like? Hey, it's nice to see you again. You know, you're catching up, you're shooting the breeze, talking about hunting or sports or life or whatever it is you're into. And then halfway through, they'll be like, well, how's church? And you go, well, actually, I'm really, you know, and it just happens so much smoother. And I think the results hit so much deeper where you're saying, I'm not just receiving kind of this advice of just this abstract advice. I'm receiving from a friend who sees me and understands my situation, you know.
Well, and hopefully if they build those relationships at those events, they carry on throughout the year.
Yeah.
Some of our rural situations, they're remote. I mean,
yeah. They don't call anybody. They're not going to see anybody, you know?
Yeah. One town in South Dakota has a geocache called the McFurthest.
Oh my gosh, because it's furthest from McDonald's?
It's the furthest place in the lower 48 states from a McDonald's.
I know Montana has we have that honorary dignity of having a Starbucks town like that, where it's like, I think we're geographically still the farthest from a Starbucks, you know?
Yeah, probably.
It's so funny, but... Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, this next question just kind of looks at this one. I will admit, this is kind of a something I want to dive into because I'm very passionate about it. You know, I've had lots of back and forth on this, but especially since the church growth movement really started. You know, we think even things like as far back as the 90s, you know, with Purpose-Driven Church and Rick Warren and what he did. And then really from there, there's been no shortage of leadership books about how to best multiply your church and how to change your role as pastor so that you become less of this kind of boots on the ground person and more of an organizer of others to do, you know. And I'm not— this is not a question to bash any of that. I think all that has obviously produced some genuine impact. However, we talk a lot in leadership circles about this multiplication principles and this concept of growth as a science and a goal. But what I loved is when I talked to you about this or when it came up, you had, if I can use this term, just a little pushback, just a little like, hey, that's all well and good, but here's what I'm worried about. Are we aware that by gaining this, we might lose this? And so, you know, you talked a little bit about ministry with a personal touch. Can you just elaborate on what I'm assuming? Because I'm going to say you're probably— your next words are not going to be, man, they're dead wrong and they're all idiots. You know, that's probably not it. But you're probably going to say, hey, there's a tension and we got to manage it. So tell me that from your perspective.
I think you have to understand that the majority of the churches in the Assemblies of God are under 100.
And we can assume, too, this would happen cross-denominationally, like probably.
Absolutely. And internationally. Yeah. You go overseas, and the majority of your churches are rural churches.
Sure.
So there are some principles in the church multiplication process, and not exclusive to the Assemblies of God by far.
Sure.
Some of these things, they are great, and they work. People have experienced great growth by using some of these principles. There are others of these principles that are really— they don't work in rural settings.
Sure.
Not every principle is going to be appropriate for every situation. So my pushback is you have to be selective.
Mm.
You can't take a cookie cutter approach and say, well, man, this worked in Phoenix. Why won't it work in Murdo?
Yeah.
Well, hello, you know, Phoenix, I don't know what the population is.
it's in millions. You know, it's bigger than us, you know.
But, you know, Murdo is less than 100 people. So
you can't
transpose what works in Phoenix and put it in Murdo and expect the same results.
Sure. Yeah, I can even think of a situation that came up where there was a friend who, you know, they were a pastor and they were like, a small town, you know, and they said, well, people are upset because I don't give out my cell number, you know, but they were like, but a pastor doesn't do that. And I was like, oh, well, I think a pastor does do that in a town that expects to like know and personally reach their pastor. You know, there's less like what would be normal and expected in a larger church context. Oh yeah, we don't actually, you know, need to be personally in touch with that person. You know, we're very much more okay with this social distance from it. In a small town is maybe considered like offensive, you know, like, hey, why are you so distant or cold or professional? Like, we're trying to get to know you personally, you know?
Right. Well, you know, there was a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And that principle, you know, embodied in that title is totally valid.
Sure.
As a church grows, the way you pastor has to change.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've heard that for years. You know, if there's 500 people in the building versus 100 versus 1,000, those are all different rules and different playing styles, you know.
But I think it's easier to get into the thought process that this church isn't growing when you've got only 50 people.
Sure.
But if you look at it and say, well, how many did we have last year and the year before? Well, you had 50 for the last 10 years.
Sure.
Well, then your church has grown just by attrition. You're losing people. You've got kids graduating high school, going off to college.
Yeah.
You've got people, elderly people that pass away. So just look at the numbers. You have grown.
Mm.
You have been doing something right, or you wouldn't have 50 today.
Yeah.
And you know, the goal of, well, we've got to double the church. We've got to quadruple the church. We got to see exponential growth.
Sure.
Well, if you've got 100 people in your community or 500 people in your community, you don't have the potential
for
exponential growth that you might have if you were in, you know, Minneapolis or
sometimes it's a numbers game. You know, the classic statement of like, well, I grew my church from 100 to 5,000. You're like, my entire county is 2,322 people.
Exactly.
You know, like, it's just like, like, we're not just talking a miracle. We're talking like a bread and fish multiplication miracle. You know, like, we're talking about people just moving, you know, it's just.
And I love the stories of a church in a very rural area that actually has more people attending than they have in their town.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are fun. Absolutely. Where they have regional impact.
But those are rare.
Yeah.
That's not in every community. So I don't think you can use all of the principles of church multiplication in every situation. I think you have to pick and choose which ones will work in your setting.
And I think the goal is, if I'm right, Pastor Stephen, is just to kind of maybe take the pressure off a little bit, to be like, hey, yes, give it your all, work your hardest, small town pastor. But like, at the end of the day, you know, would you say that's accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, it's the God factor when the church grows. It's certainly not how smart we are, or how good we are.
Yeah, if the church depended on us, man, boy, howdy.
Exactly. So you know, let God grow the church. And then you just kind of have to get out of the way. Let him do it.
Absolutely. Man, that's phenomenal. Okay, looking at our next thoughts here, your various pastoral positions, you know, you mentioned starting as a youth pastor, being there about a year and a half, you know, going as a lead pastorate, being there about 4 years, and then in between kind of these stints of working with your network on a more real basis, you know, you've been maybe somewhere, you know, a couple years here, 4 years there. And so you've had kind of these, sometimes these shorter tenures in actual pastorates, which just inevitably by definition leads to a lot of moments in your life where you've had to walk into a position and walk out of a position. And especially in small towns, transition can be really hard. You know, like I've seen churches where the pastor was there 30 years and when they left, the entire church just like crumbled. And I don't even think it's the pastor's fault. It just is what it is. You know, it just is like kind of the nature of it. And so you've had to step in and step out of places. So how does one maybe personally prepare for transition? How does one help a church through transition?
I remember reading an article about John Maxwell.
Okay.
And he pastored a great church in Southern Cal. And he felt God leading him away from that pastor situation. And I think he went on to do more consulting and writing books. But he made a determination that if he announced his resignation when he got to church, people weren't going to hear anything he had to say after that.
Okay.
If he preached and then at the end of his sermon, he announced his resignation, people weren't going to remember anything he said before that.
Okay.
It was kind of like a lost Sunday. And
he determined
that wasn't a good thing. So what he did, I kind of modeled after that. I started doing something similar. He went to his board and he resigned. He then sent a letter that was timed to get to, you know, everybody in the church by Friday or Saturday of that week.
Sure.
So before Sunday, everybody had received a letter and it kind of laid it all out. Here's what I feel God telling me.
Sure.
Here, this will be the process. And then I added one other thing. I went personally to every one of the deacons that had served with me over the time that I was there.
Sure.
People that were currently on the board or maybe who weren't anymore. And I met with them personally, sat down, had coffee with them, told them this is what's happening.
Mm.
So when I got to church on Sunday morning, they had already had a chance to either mourn or cheer or whatever they were going to do.
Yeah. I mean, you got to leave room for both, you know.
Yeah. And so I still had something that I could say that they would remember.
Mm.
And I felt like that was one of the tools.
Sure.
That God put in my heart to do when I would transition. So, you know, does that make it easy for a congregation? Absolutely not.
Sure.
I mean, there, you know, we lived in a parsonage in Watertown and we loved the Watertown church, never planned to ever leave there.
Sure.
We put a rope up in a tree for our kids as a rope swing. And when we were planning to leave, I saw the rope swing and I thought, I don't know if the next pastor is even going to have kids. And I thought,
sure,
I'm taking that rope with me. And
yeah.
I climbed up into the tree, and the tree had overlapped the rope.
So you couldn't even get it out.
I couldn't get it out. And to me, that was a picture of what had happened to us.
Yeah.
With the congregation. Our sure. lives had intermeshed and woven together. And there's a part of me that will never leave that church.
Yeah.
Because I know those people. I love those people. And our relationship continues at a different level. I'm not their pastor.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help but still love people. I mean, if you've invested your life in them, you've been there for weddings and funerals and baby dedications. Yeah. And now we've got missionaries that grew up in that church. We got ministers that grew up in that church that I was a part of their lives. I did their baby dedication or I did their wedding or and now they're out still in ministry. You don't cut yourself away from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you do it well? Maybe you're asking the wrong guy. Maybe somebody who doesn't let themselves get emotionally attached could do it better. But
sure. But it also, going back to kind of our main premise, is like a relational leader is someone who invests deeply because it's the right thing to do. And I do think there's a dichotomy from what you presented. You know, in one sense, you said, I worked really hard to be upfront, to be as impactful as I could, to make sure I was practically sharing in a way that would allow me to not just share the news, but really preach through that news and to communicate my heart. Like, those are all practical tips. But I think there's some health in just acknowledging, like, we call it like irreducible complexity. Like, there's no way to actually make it hurt less. If you do it right and you're ingrown, like you said, that rope in the tree. It just is what it is. And I think for a pastor to accept that grief and allow others in their church to accept that grief is probably a huge part of how to transition well out of a scenario.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people grieve in different ways. You know, if you look at the stages of grief, one of them is anger.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And as an exiting pastor, you can't take that personally. That they're not angry at you. They're not angry at God. They're just
feeling loss.
They're feeling loss, and that's the way they're expressing it. So give them space, let them grieve, and let God be the one who helps them to move on. I mean, you can do all you can, but it's ultimately God's church. It never was mine.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as we kind of begin to wind down our conversation, which is, of course, a made-up term that pastors use, but as we begin to wind down, I kind of have two questions, two sides of the same coin. One of them, the first I'm going to ask you, is really, you know, you are now looking back on a career that has spanned several decades. I mean, even just one of your stints, 24 years as superintendent, dwarfs my time in ministry, and not quite how long I've been alive, because that would be a bit of an understatement, but it's, you know, you've been at this a while. Which brings with it a lot of positive things, a lot of wisdom, a lot of experience. And so I'm going to give you kind of a negative prompt here. If you're talking to younger ministers, what's one word of caution or challenge you would pass on? You know, you're looking back going, hey, the church has to carry on even as I step out in certain capacities, you know, and what's the challenge ahead of us? But then the other question I'm going to ask you to follow it is just, what's kind of the secret sauce in your mind? You know, how do you stay in ministry long term? Because I think that's such a challenge. And so we're going to start with the word of challenge. Then we're going to kind of go on to a word of encouragement. So why don't you kick us off? What's the situation like ahead, and how do we be aware of that? You know,
I think, Joe, the culture today is one of our biggest challenges, because the culture has turned. Pastoring is different today than it was 20 years ago.
Sure.
And certainly totally different than it was 50 years ago.
Sure.
Our culture is what has changed. It used to be that people would fight you in a church to get you as the pastor to leave if they felt you were out of line. Today, they will leave the church.
Oh, wow. I never thought of that.
They're not into fighting. Very few are into dividing the church up and we're going to stay here until the last dog dies.
Sure.
So you have to be aware of the culture. Don't let the culture rule or dominate what happens in the church. Stay pure in your thoughts. Stay pure in your intentions.
Sure.
Don't become conniving. Don't become manipulative. You know, that may be the way someone else leads. That's not the way Jesus led.
Mm.
And that's not the way pastors should
sure.
lead. Secondly, don't marry the church.
Okay.
If you're married, you have a husband or a wife, and that is your relationship. That is a primary. That needs to go ahead of
sure.
your relationship with the church. So your relationship in order, first to God, secondly to your partner, and third to the church.
Mm.
So, you know, don't short your spouse to fulfill what you think is ministry. Because your first ministry is to your wife and family, or to your husband and family.
Sure.
I'm very careful to say that, because I believe we've got several women pastors
yeah.
here in South Dakota. I believe that God has gifted them specifically for pastoral ministry.
Amen.
And it's important. So, yeah, stay pure in your thoughts, your intentions, your actions, and make sure your priorities, God, family, church, are in order.
So then going from there then to kind of this more encouraging, kind of this final word, this nugget of wisdom, but like when it turns into, you know, what is it that helps you stay in ministry for the long haul? What is that to you? Is there a certain phrase that sticks in your mind? Is there a certain devotional practice? Is it kind of just what you just said, you know, just saying, hey, these are how to stay on the straight and narrow? You know, I'm curious.
I think those are good things, but I would say something I had built in my first pastorate was my presbyter was also my dad.
Okay. Yeah. So you're kind of, you had a supervising partner there, and obviously, yeah, it was your dad. Okay.
So I would call him up and say, Dad, I need you to put your presbyter hat on.
Sure.
Help me with this. I remember my first funeral, my very first funeral.
Yeah.
As a lead pastor, it was a 16-year-old boy who had committed suicide.
Oh my gosh. That's heavy.
A young couple in the church that had just come into the church just months before that. Was his sister and brother-in-law. So their younger brother and brother-in-law pulled the trigger on a pistol.
Sure.
And committed suicide. So what do you say? So I'm on the phone talking to my dad.
Yeah.
Dad, I need your help. Talk to me now as that lead pastor, that presbyter.
Yeah, somebody who knows what's up, yeah.
What I should say, what I shouldn't say. Because I really don't know what to say. He gave me great words of counsel.
Mm.
And for that specific event, he told me, shared with me a scripture, and I can't remember the reference now. It's Old Testament. It says, shall not the judge of all this earth do right?
Mm.
Just kind of a rhetorical question. Of course he will.
But yeah, leaving it in the hands of God. Like what a powerful counsel to give for a tough situation.
So, man, I leaned into that. That was one of my texts in that sermon. And I preached God's grace, God's love, and God's presence with the family. He's here for you. And so I say, find a mentor. If you're not as fortunate as I am, find someone near you. It might be a presbyter. It might be someone clear across state that you're not close physically to, geographically, but someone that has that godly counsel, that wisdom that you can tap into whenever you're in need. Because, boy, there will be times you don't have the answers.
Yeah.
And so that would be a strong encouragement. The other one is stay humble. You know, there are a lot of circumstances in life that will make you humble.
Sure.
I remember going to church one Sunday night, and it was Rachel and I and one deacon, his wife, and his two daughters.
That there you was go. It. Reaching people for the kingdom of God.
You know, and I thought about preaching the whole message, doing the song service, doing everything. Because it would have been the pattern. And we sang some together. We prayed together. And we shared scripture together. But, you know, I wasn't up at the pulpit and them down in the pew. We were sitting together. We were talking. We were sharing. You can't be so proud that you think you're the greatest stuff and that the word that you've got is, you know, you've got to preach the whole thing.
Sure.
You probably heard the story about the farmer. He came to church one Sunday and it was just he and the pastor. The pastor preached the whole message, took the offering, had the song service. And at the end, the pastor talking with the farmer, he says, "Well, I know you were the only one here, but I just felt like it was the right thing to do." He says, "Well, pastor, I understand, but if I only had one cow that came to the barn, I wouldn't feed him the whole truckload."
That's really good. So, yeah, that's really good.
I understand that, you know, if you're in a rural situation, there will be times when the numbers won't be very good.
Yeah.
But just stay faithful. You keep doing what God's asked you to do. Keep loving people. Keep sharing the word with them. Preach the word. Don't preach headlines or internet news. That'll really mess things up. Preach the word and let the Holy Spirit anoint it. And let him be the one who brings the increase.
Amen. And well, Pastor Stephen, thank you very much. I really appreciate your insights today. And again, I feel like we've gotten to peel back a layer. One of my favorite role models academically, I have not gotten to know him personally, but is Eugene Peterson, right? Grew up in Montana and wrote such phenomenal works on what it means to like live and die with people, to truly do the art of pastoring. And I just really, your story and the way you've approached ministry has just been so encouraging along those same lines of just saying, how are we perfecting this art of living and dying with people and just serving them. And so thank you for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
My privilege. Thank you for the opportunity. It's always good to talk with you, Joe.
Absolutely. Well, hey, from all of us at Rural Advancement, we just want to say again, we hope that you're leaving today's conversation challenged, encouraged, equipped. We want you to know that God sees you, what you're doing. We see you, and we really do try and bring content that speaks right where you're at, that understands your pressures, but also rejoices in your victories as God brings them. And so, you know, very practically speaking, you can always find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or at ruraladvancement.com, along with a host of other resources. But really, the best way to spread this conversation around is just in a very rural fashion, just finding somebody else and telling them, hey, you need to hear some conversations that'll bless you. And so for this week, I've been your host, Joe Epley. He's been Pastor Stephen Shibley, and we will see you next week.